Well, you'd never guess whose turn it is now, would you? They've kept me till the very last Sabbath of the year. I suppose hoping there wouldn't be so many here, but welcome visitors, and there's plenty of you here today. We're glad that you are here. As my wife and I were just thinking as we were driving to church this morning, I wonder how many will be here. There'll be so-and-so here, there'll be such-and-such here, there may be someone here for Sabbath school, there may be whatever, but there's a lot more than what we're expecting. So thank you. Wendy, thank you for the welcome. Tim, thank you for living his love, and Emily for the offering as well to go with that, and for Joe for your prayer as well. Thank you for that, and worship team. I'm not going to name you all, but thank you for that also. It's the end of the year. How many do make New Year resolutions? There's a few dishonest people here. They're not prepared to put their hands up, aren't they? Hey? I gave up a few years back making New Year's resolutions because, Wendy, I have to confess, I didn't even get to one. So well done on doing one. But anyway, it is the end of this year, of 2019. Next year, we're going to have perfect vision. 2020. How good is that? And timing is everything, you know. And so this morning, I actually want to talk about God's timing. And our scripture reading today comes in Genesis chapter 45 and verse 7. Genesis 45 verse 7, and I'm going to read from the New English version of the Bible. And in Genesis 45 verse 7 it says, "But God sent me ahead of you to preserve you for a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance." You know, I don't know what you think about timing. My mother has relayed many stories to us about timing in our household, particularly with Dad. One in particular, where if Dad said that we were going to be leaving to go somewhere at a certain time, we would be driving out the driveway at that certain time. Even if Mum was still dressing me for church and my younger sister. And I suppose that that may come from the fact that his father was a watchmaker and always liked to keep a track of time. But Dad also would go around the house. The cuckoo clock had to be on the right time. His watch had to be on the right time. All the other clocks had to be wound up to the right time. How would you check the time? Was it 1194 that you would ring? On the third beep, the time will be such and such. I believe that they've only just cut that out this year, of that phone number. But, you know, it has been considered that time is, in fact, a common language. And it allows everybody to proceed in an orderly fashion. And I notice that I'm not meant to finish at 11:53 today, too. Thank you, Caroline, for that. And because of this, the measurement of time has actually become extremely important to our lives. Do we agree with that? Or has it become an obsession? Nanoseconds will mark the difference between success or failure in making an electronic transaction. How many of us now bank electronically? Yep. How often do we get upset if we don't see that money being transferred immediately? Who remembers dial-up internet? How long did it take to get online? How complacent were you when it dropped out and you had to dial back up again? Who remembers computers? The XP computer. The 186. The 286. And we'd really made it if we had a 386 computer. That was fast. But did you know that in the 365.25 days of the year, that there's only around about 31,557,600 seconds? Now, we normally talk about seconds or nanoseconds in medical terms, I suppose. But who has heard of the ottosecond? You have? The ottosecond is what? The ottosecond is 10 to the power of 24, yes. Which equals only 31.7 quadrillion years. Just in case you're wondering. But you know, in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, it also describes time. In what basis? In chapter 1 of Genesis, it started off with, there was evening and morning. So it only went from one day to the next, didn't it? The ancient Egyptians had sundials. And they divided those intervals into 12 equal segments between sunrise and sunset. The Romans came up with the water clocks. Why did they choose a water clock? So they could tell the time when the sun wasn't shining, or at night time, or on foggy days. However, they still had to calibrate their water clocks by the sundial at that stage. Then, of course, came atoms and lasers. The atomic clock was in the 1950s, the laser was in the 1960s, and a laser can produce a pulse duration of a few attoseconds, which, for those that are more technically minded, 10 to the power of minus 18. But today we actually don't define time by a second, which is 1 over 86,400th of a day. We actually use an atomic frequency. It's called a cesium standard. Now, the atomic clock measures the frequency of electromagnetic radiation that's emitted by an atom or a molecule. And because the atom or the molecule can only emit or absorb a certain specific amount of energy, that's how the radiation emitted or absorbed has a regular frequency. So the National Institute of Standards and Technology established the second as the amount of time radiation would take to go through 9,192,631,770 cycles at the frequency emitted by the cesium atom, which is making it change from one state to another. Now that's 1 second. All right, 9,192,631,770 cycles. But I suppose the big question is this. Does God really work to our definition, interpretation, and measurement of time? Or how often do we actually work to God's timing? That came up in this morning's lesson up back here in the church, talking about God's timing. And so this morning I'd like us just to have a quick look between the books of the book of Genesis in chapter 37, where we talk about Joseph. Now, I believe that Joseph is a lot like most of us in one important aspect. Unlike some other Bible characters, he had no specific promise from God concerning the timing of his future, but what it would look like. And there's six parts to the story. The first part starts in Genesis chapter 37. And you may notice that I don't have any technology flashing behind me today, I hope. I thought I'd steer clear of PowerPoints. But Genesis chapter 37. What do we learn about in this first part of Joseph's story? Starting from verse 3 through to verse 11. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age. And he made a richly ornamented robe for him. And when his brother saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. And Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. And he said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brother said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. And then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." And when he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" And in verse 11 it says that his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in heart, in mind. So two dreams. His brothers hated him for both of them. Why did his brothers hate him? They were jealous of him. He was the favoured son. And then let's have a look at verse 19 in chapter 37, where we know the story about that Joseph has gone out to try and find where his brothers are. And in verse 9 it says, "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. And in verse 20, "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him, and then we'll see what comes of his dreams." In verse 23, "So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern." And in verse 25, "As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. And their camels were loaded with spices, balm and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt." And in verse 28, "So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites who took him to Egypt." Now, what's significant about the 20 shekels of silver? Was the price of a male person that was dedicated to the Lord that was between the ages of 5 and 20 years of age. Now, how old was Joseph? He was 17. So his brothers sold him for 20 shekels of silver. We're going to skip chapter 38, but we're going to go to chapter 39. Because what happens in chapter 39? Joseph turns up in Egypt, and he is sold to who? To Potiphar. He was one of Pharaoh's officials, it says in chapter 39 and verse 1. And in verse 2, I want to highlight this part. The Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered, and he highlighted in the house of his Egyptian master. And when his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favour in his eyes and became his attendant. And Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted him to his care everything that he owned. But there's another part of the story in this chapter, isn't there? That was when Potiphar's wife thought that Joseph was a little bit better than some of the other servants in the place. It didn't put him in good stead, because where did he end up? In prison. Well, I want you to go down to chapter 39 and verse 20. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favour in the eyes of the prison warden. And so the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. But what happens while Joseph's in prison? He meets two particular guys, doesn't he? One is what? The cupbearer. Who's the other one? The baker. Okay, and in chapter 40, we learn about the cupbearer. And in verses 7 and 8, it says, "When Joseph came to them the next morning, he saw that they were dejected." This is both the cupbearer and the baker. "And so he asked Pharaoh's officials who were in custody with him in his master's house, 'Why are your faces so sad today?' 'We both had dreams,' they answered, 'but there is no one to interpret them.' And then Joseph said to them, 'Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams.'" So Joseph helped with the dreams. And what was the first dream that the cupbearer had? It said that the cupbearer told him his dream about three branches and clusters of grapes, and the Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup and put the cup to his hand. What does it all mean? Joseph's interpretation of that was that you're going to be restored to the king's palace. The baker heard that this was a favourable outcome. So the baker goes to Joseph and asks him the interpretation of his dream. Wasn't quite so favourable, was it? Because what happened to the baker? He got hanged. It wasn't good. But what did Joseph ask of the cupbearer when the cupbearer left the prison? "Please remember me." And then we know that after that, Pharaoh had a dream. In fact, we know that it was 2 years later that Pharaoh had the dream. And he asked, "Who in all this kingdom can actually help interpret my dream?" That's when the cupbearer remembers Joseph, 2 years later. And so he asks him to come out. And in chapter 41, in verse 1, it says, "When 2 full years had passed, Pharaoh had a dream. And he was standing by the Nile, and when out of the Nile, there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. And among them 7 other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up out of the Nile and stood beside those on the riverbank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the 7 sleek, fat cows. And then Pharaoh woke up. And then he fell asleep, fell asleep again and had a second dream, and 7 heads of grain, healthy and good, were growing on a single stalk. And after them, 7 other heads of grain sprouted, thin and scorched by the east wind. And the thin heads of grain swallowed up the 7 healthy heads. And then Pharaoh woke up." So when the cupbearer said, "I know of someone who can actually interpret these dreams for you," Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I had a dream." And this is in verse 15 of chapter 41. "I had a dream and no one can interpret it, but I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." And in verse 16, "I cannot do it," Joseph replied to Pharaoh, "but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires." And so, in verse 39 of chapter 41, what happens? "Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace. And all my people are submit to your orders, and only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you.'" Yes, I've skipped a fair part of the story about the 7 good years and the 7 lean years. But the fact was that in 3 stages, Joseph has been put in charge. He was put in charge in Potiphar's house. He was put in charge in the prison. And now he's put in charge of all of Egypt, except for the throne. How's your math so far? Wendy, I won't ask you because you said you weren't good at math. Okay? How old roughly is Joseph at this stage? I think you find that by the time that Joseph is actually put in charge, he left home at 17. He's been in Potiphar's house, he's been in prison 2 years later. I would suggest that he's somewhere within his mid-30s. Would that be right? I hope so, otherwise my math is out of whack too. Of course, then we know the story in chapter 42 of how Joseph's brothers come down and ask for grain because they've run out of grain in their home country. The drought has set in. But when the brothers come to Joseph and ask for grain, do you know it's also 2 years after? So at what age is Joseph now that he's actually meeting up with his family again for the first time? Joseph is nearing 40 years of age. Now, he's left home when he is 17. So he has lived in captivity, for the want of a better term, longer than he's actually lived with his family. And of course, we know that Joseph played a few tricks on his brothers as well. He accused them of being what? Spies. He accused them of all sorts of things. But this is the point that I want to come to. And in Genesis chapter 45 and verses 1 to 8, it says here that Joseph could no longer control himself. Before all his attendants, he cried out, "Have everyone leave my presence." So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him and Pharaoh's household heard about it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. I wonder what their memories were like. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." And when they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will not be ploughing or reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve you for a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance." And in the beginning of verse 8 it says this, "So then it was not you who sent me here, but God." Of course, in chapter 46 of Genesis, we know that Joseph is reunited with his family because he's asked them all to come down to Egypt with Pharaoh's blessing. And he meets up with his father in that again. But you know, there's three things about Joseph's life, and it could be this. Number one, Joseph's pain was the key to his greatness. Joseph was the favourite son. Charles Swindoll writes in his book, Joseph, a Man of Integrity and Forgiveness, "By giving Joseph this elaborate full-length coat, which was also a sign of nobility in that day, his father was boldly implying, 'You can wear this beautiful garment because you don't have to work like those brothers of yours.'" You wonder where his brother's jealousy may have come from. Joseph had to learn to work. Joseph's gifts of administration and oversight start to become apparent as Potiphar gave Joseph complete administrative responsibility over everything he owned. His gifts developed even further as he became in charge of the prison that he was in and eventually over all of Egypt. And in the end, it was Joseph's God-given gifts of administration and oversight that God used to save Joseph's family and the whole nation of Egypt from starvation. It's suggested that had Joseph never had the hardship of being sold into slavery, he may never have tapped into those gifts and consequently never would have saved his family. Point number two, Joseph ministered to others in his darkest time. Joseph's life appeared to be filled with setbacks on the surface, But in fact, every situation was there to mature him and test him and ultimately set him up for God's plan to be manifested through him. Of course, after being wrongfully charged, he found himself in prison. But he was placed in charge of prisoners during that time. Joseph actually showed a kind and compassionate spirit. And Joseph put himself aside and helped others during his own suffering. Point number three, Joseph didn't try to make his own agenda, did not try to push his own agenda in his life. Yes, Joseph asked the cupbearer to remember him. But the cupbearer, of course, forgot him. And Joseph remained in prison for another 2 years. But the cupbearer did finally remember him. And when Joseph was brought out of prison, he was able to share one of his God-given gifts by helping someone in authority. Joseph was released from prison and put into a high place of authority in just one day. He left home at 17 years of age. He'd been in captivity for longer than he'd actually lived at home, but it only took one day of an interpretation of Pharaoh's dream for him to be placed in a position of authority. And Joseph's comment to Pharaoh was this: God has revealed this to you. We spoke in the Sabbath school lesson this morning about humble leaders. I don't think we could have found anyone more humble than Joseph in this regard. But how are our lives going so far? Which of the characters and experiences in Joseph's story can we relate to the most? Maybe we are able to relate to more than just one. Maybe in the characters of Joseph's brothers, or the cupbearer, or whomever. Lisa Apollo is a writer in the US, and she writes about seven reasons that you can trust God's perfect timing. The first one is this: God created time and rules over it. In Genesis 1, one of the first things he created was time. We also see this in Joshua chapter 10. What did Joshua ask God to do? He asked the sun to go back so he could finish off the Amorites properly. Point number two, God chooses to work gradually over time. And she suggests that it pleases God to actually unfold his plan over time, just like Joseph's. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11, he has made everything beautiful in its time, and he has also set eternity in the hearts of men. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. God took 6 days to create each aspect of heaven and earth. And though he promised a redeemer to Adam and Eve after they had sinned, how long did that take? It'd be thousands of years later before Christ would be born. Point three, God isn't bound by deadlines. And the author, Corrie ten Boom, has said there is no panic in heaven. Point four, God knows the end from the beginning in Isaiah 46, verses 9 to 10. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is none else. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things are not yet done. God doesn't know just now what will happen. He's known it from eternity past. Point five, time is not our enemy. God created time. God uses time for his purposes and specifically determined the time each of us would be born, as well as the span of our life. God rules over time, and there is enough time today, this year, and this life to complete the full will of God for our lives. Time is not our enemy. God has provided the perfect amount of time for each of us to do his will each day. Point six, there is no fear of missing out. Joseph hadn't been passed by while he was in prison. God was just waiting for the perfect opportunity to place him in a position of prominence and influence. And point seven, God works everything for good in his timing. How often have we heard this verse in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28? For the good of God works all things for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. But at times we can add three little words on the end, in our lifetime. Tim, you spoke about in our lifetime that you might not see things happen. That may be the case. But those words aren't there. God is eternal, and his work continues long after our life here is over. We may not see the fullness of God's good in our lifetime. But what if we're not sure of God's timing? What can we do? What do you think is the first thing? We can pray. Use the time wisely. Spend more time in prayer and reading Scripture. Maybe January 8 to 18 is a good starting point. Number two, don't strive. Trust God. Timing is everything. How often have we heard that term? You know, there may be times when he just simply wants us to wait. And in Psalm 46:10, David writes this, "Cease striving and know that I am God." The third part, do what we can with what we have where we are. You know, as unthinkable as it may seem, we are exactly where God has placed us. Joseph wasn't in Egypt by choice. He had no idea how God was working. What his brothers did to him was evil. But it led directly to his ability to save the lives of many people. So thinking of Jesus as born in a manger and then at the end of his life hung on the cross, it was the greatest evil, I believe, in the world's history. But God used it to accomplish the greatest good. When Jesus was at his lowest point, he was right in the very heart of God's plan for world redemption. And when he rose from the dead, he opened the way to eternal life for all who believe. So what has happened to each of us over our lifetimes thus far? Are we in a place where we can honestly say, as Joseph said to his brothers, God has sent me ahead of you to preserve you, a remnant on earth, and to save your lives by great deliverance? Genesis 45:7 in the New Living Translation states it this way, God has sent me ahead of you to keep you and your families alive and to preserve many survivors. And the beginning of verse 8, so it was God who sent me here, not you. Do you believe God has brought us here for a reason today? I do. We don't have to concern ourselves about the accuracy of atomic clocks or that a yota second is equal to the 10 to the power of 24, being about how many years again? 31.7 quadrillion years. We may not understand God's reasoning for today, tomorrow, or next week, next month, or even next year. And in fact, maybe not even in our current lifetime. But today is a moment in God's plans and timing for each of us. So let's keep our focus on God and continue to live in patience, integrity, and character, just as Joseph did. And have the confidence that God will come through for us at his perfect timing. It is my firm belief that God has sent each of us ahead to preserve and save. But none are lost in his eternal kingdom. As we move into 2020, may we have the faith and assurance that Joseph had. It was not you who sent me here, but God.